That was a big reason I wanted to move to America, because I knew every single model, make of motorcycle that was sold in America even before I came to America as a kid.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sandhill Road.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
There's a document floating around Silicon Valley. You'll find it in the boardrooms at General Catalyst, Bain Capital, IVP, Lux Capital, and here at the table I'm sitting at Insight Partners.
We wanted to bring the ecosystem together so we can all commit to innovating responsibly and create a framework.
Ganesh Bell at Insight talking about the document, the framework that venture and startups are using as a written agreement about AI.
The framework actually has five different things. One is, the first thing is actually committing to responsible AI.
The second, transparency, followed by predicting the risks of AI and auditing and testing. And finally, a promise to make improvements as needed. Pretty simple, really. A promise made by startups to venture firms that fund them.
And it's not a tough bar, you know. Be responsible, be transparent.
Exactly. It is just an additional hygiene that we're bringing to the boardroom, if you will, right?
Have you had anyone object to it?
No, not really.
What devil's advocate? Give me the objection argument.
The objection argument seems to be, again, you have to ask the people that are objecting. If you listen to them, I actually only hear the fact that they agree with this. They agree with the fact right. that AI needs to be regulated. They agree with the fact that we need some frameworks and guardrails around AI. They agree with the fact that AI possesses lots of possibilities as well as dangers. So really, the only valid point I've seen is the forcible enforcement of this in startups and, you know, bringing
down
the innovation bar.
There is no punishment phase. There's no if you don't, then.
Yeah. So you saw the EU regulation come to pass. The details of it are still yet coming. And I'm sure there will be some level of compliance period, for example, right? And you have interesting cases that are developing, like OpenAI versus New York Times, right? So there's similarly a lot of things that startups have to go through on basic HR policy, legal policy, what is fair use, what is training, and what is generally acceptable, and also be more mindful. Some of this is also just being mindful.
The agreement, called the Responsible AI Agreement, was created in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Commerce.
If there were to be an objection, I, you know, kind of searched around for it, but I didn't find anyone particularly worried or upset that the government was involved, that the Commerce Department was involved, that, you know, there is this pushback, particularly among conservative circles, about, you know, how much government should be involved in social networks and what social networks should have to report back to the government, that kind of stuff. There was very little pushback as far as private industry, private money, and the U.S. Commerce Department, you know, teaming up, even if with the best intentions.
I agree with you. The only pushback we've seen from some star investors looks more like grandstanding and wanting to appear to be more founder-friendly and casting others who are taking an initiative here to not appear as founder-friendly. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We are being founder-friendly because our founders need these resources. And I think the government has taken the right steps by putting it in the Department of Commerce, for example. And we do have examples of great regulation in FAA, FDA, and, you know, AI is a horizontal technology. It's going to affect every single regulatory body out there, every single technology department. So I think it is important that we are at the early stages of this, working as a community. So I think it's great that IBM, Meta, and everybody else launches AI Alliance, and there are other institutions like that. So we will be part of as many as we can be, so we can bring that learnings and help our entrepreneurs.
You and I sort of made the analogy of AI policy being a little bit like DEI, that, you know, these are just things that you have to deal with. As I'm thinking about AI, the analogy, having moved to Silicon Valley in 1997, is the dot-com boom. But that's an imperfect analogy.
Actually, you may be onto something there. If you think about, you know, AI, I came to America about 30 years ago. AI was the hottest thing when I came to grad school.
AI?
Yes. And we went through a long, cold winter. I was just, you know, last month I was at NeurIPS, a conference in New Orleans where it was 13,000 machine learning, data science, AI people, which has been going on since, I think, 1987. Okay, so this has been long happening, just like, you know, the internet was
right.
Around
the dot-com boom didn't just come out of nowhere. Somebody invented the Ethernet and the
DARPANET
Mosaic
was there.
Web browser.
Exactly, right? And then something happened and our expectation of the world changed. We could no longer forecast and everything seemed like a great idea. And we had to go through lots of the early versions of, you know, search engines and social networking. Those don't exist anymore, right? The search engine now is very different than what Alta Vista was.
Right.
Right? So I kind of, there is an analogy there. Maybe that is how AI is happening right now. But the way to think about it is also just like mobile and cloud was big, technology shifts grew the pie, if you will, and also forced the, what is called the digital transformation, right? Which is every industry, every business getting reimagined in data and in software. I think AI is just an accelerant. And in some ways, I think the AI transformation is going to be even bigger because I think it will force us to reimagine things for the very first time. Because mobile and cloud, in a lot of ways, you got away with just re-implementing the same idea. Whereas with AI, and again, we've had this thing that is discriminative or predictive AI for quite some time. The big imagination that has captured everybody's imagination over the last year or so is this generative AI.
Right.
And that is still in the early days.
Yeah, right? that's generative AI is what really, you know, hey, write me a limerick that uses, you know, my dog's name sort of thing. It's sort of basic, but it really captured people's imagination in a way that, you know, like predictive AI that, you know, predicts a windmill, is going to fail this part. That doesn't quite excite the soul the same way.
Yes, exactly. And AI has been meaningfully deployed in many applications, many industries, creating, you know, billions of dollars of value, both societal and economic, over the last decade. And generative has a much bigger potential. So I think the reimagination of pretty much everything that we know is really what's exciting. And also why, you know, we care about safety. We care about lots of the right tools that we want to have for the next generation of computing.
Incumbents, I think, have the advantage here, right? I mean, in the dot-com boom, any people with a computer and internet access could create, you know, something.com. It's different with AI because of the data sets you need.
Yeah, I think that is a really good point of debate that we have internally within the firm, and I always have with the friends. Do incumbents automatically win? It seems like in the early innings, the incumbents probably have the biggest halo effect of AI because they have distribution advantage. They can quickly incorporate AI into their applications. But what we haven't seen is this unfold quite a bit, right? If you take that as an analogy, incumbents win when new technology shifts happen. That hasn't been true in the past. It wasn't true in cloud.
AOL
wasn't true in mobile. And the reason that isn't true is not just because the tech. Yes, AI is easier to incorporate than any other technology in the past because it's just an API call away. But I think that is only because we're just seeing the early ideas. We still haven't seen the fully reimagined ideas where generative AI is a native first-class citizen at the core. That would mean disrupting existing products, existing businesses, which incumbents are unlikely to do so because of the traditional, blocks that they have in terms of innovator's dilemma, if you will.
Right.
And I think startups that are working on the next generation of ideas, and I'll give you just my own industry. I grew up in enterprise software. I've been fortunate to be in every stage, every size of a company, from being an entrepreneur to taking companies to IPO to working in really large conglomerates. I've seen innovation happen at all levels. Innovation can happen and will happen at all levels, but there's a reason why startups come and challenge a new model. A big part of that is also culture, data obsession, and a new way of looking at things. Outsiders often create new things. So I do believe that we're probably seeing the early days of this, and I'm optimistic that it's not going to be just the incumbents that win.
Sandhill Road will be right back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Can you explain on a very basic level closed source versus open source in AI and why the average person should care?
Let me think about that.
I can ask ChatGPT if you want.
Yeah. So in closed source, right, and it's interesting, one of the biggest closed source model is called OpenAI, right? And every other large closed source model, effectively the code is not available for others to understand, nor are the parameters and the model weights that are used to tune the model. So it is effectively a black box. You can train the model and it can produce a output, and you have no way of understanding how the model actually arrived at where it arrived at. Whereas in open source, the code is available for everybody to understand the inner workings, debug, and also consistent work together as an ecosystem to contribute to open source. You also understand the tuning of the open source models because they are called model parameters and weights. So you understand the weights so you can tune the model differently. So you know how to align the model to a certain behavior if you want. Mm-hmm. If you want that chatbot, for example, to be more accurate, you can do that. If you want it to be more playful, you can do that. And in some cases, accuracy is not as important as coming up with something more creative. So you can play with that. So just being able to have a full understanding of the code base, be able to openly contribute to it. And open source, by definition, also could be more secure because more people are looking at the code Therefore, you can contribute to improvements in vulnerability that you see.
Both are perfectly reasonable ways of going about the problem.
Absolutely. Both are perfectly reasonable ways. We see companies innovating on both closed source and open source, and I think we need both.
What do you use AI for? I mean, do you incorporate it in any way in decision-making or in creative thinking?
In everyday life, I use quite a bit of AI. I probably have one of the largest HomeKit automated home instances. So I interact with my home through Siri.
Right.
And there's quite a bit of AI in it in terms of it's automating its own scenes and creating. In fact, my phone's trying to listen in on a command right now.
Yeah, lights are going on and off in your... Yes. Yeah.
And one of my favorite examples of machine learning, the original forms of machine learning is, you know, we all drive cars. We all have traction control safety systems. I ride motorcycles on a racetrack. I ride a motorcycle called Aprilia. It's one of the fastest, most sophisticated super bikes you can ride on a racetrack. And it has a sophisticated traction control system that actually learns the tire and recalibrates itself and has on-the-fly adjustment of safety maps. So it makes mere mortals like me feel like racing gods.
So you got a cheat code on your motorcycle.
It's a cheat code and also a training tool. It's kind of like a safety net, so I can keep moving the safety net.
Sure.
So when I go on a track day early in the morning, you know, the track is cold, the tires are cold, my brain's not warmed up, so I can set the safety level to be the highest. And as my brain warms up, tire warms up, and the track warms up, and as I get into the track day, I can move the safety net further and far. And so we can still catch some of my mistakes.
What first attracted you to racing motorcycles? It's, you know, it obviously sounds terribly dangerous. But what was the first moment, the first motorcycle ride, the first, oh, this is something I want to do?
Oh, I grew up in India where at that point in time, everybody had to ride a motorized two-wheeler, even if you didn't like it, because that is the only way to get around. And it's actually, you know, it's a big step up from having a bicycle. My uncle used to work for a motorcycle company called Royal Enfield. They still make motorcycles. In fact, they export them to the U.S. right now. And growing up in India, all my biggest sporting heroes were all Americans. Because Americans used to dominate the world Grand Prix motorcycle championship, now called MotoGP. And that was a big reason I wanted to move to America, because I knew every single model, make of motorcycle that was sold in America even before I came to America as a kid.
That's amazing. That's so very cool.
The funny story there is, like, when I grew up in India, my uncle used to work for, another uncle used to work for a advertising firm called, what is now called Ogilvy and Mather. And as a school kid, I would get dropped off, wait for him to finish up his chores, and go home with him because he'll buy me treats on the way home. They would have magazines lying around his office of all the magazines around the world where they placed ads. This was Forbes, Fortune, Rolling Stones, Cycle World, and Car and Driver. Guess all the things that I'm interested in today.
What is your mother think of your driving motorcycles?
She probably thinks it's a...
She hasn't said?
No, it's a commute thing, right? When you grew up in India...
Okay, an Indian mother would have a different attitude towards...
Yeah, everybody commuted on a motorcycle.
Right, but so what are you driving these things at? 160?
Say again?
How fast are you driving these things?
On the street speed limit?
No, of course. Yes, on the track.
On a racetrack, you know, you can't get up to that fast.
Yes.
The California tracks that I ride on, the Sonoma Raceway, the Laguna Seca, which is a phenomenal racetrack. I knew about that racetrack as a kid in India. And then Thunder Hill, which is one of the racetracks up north here, it's probably the fastest track. There, my motorcycle, on the straights, you can get up to 165 miles an hour.
Okay. Yeah, that just seems like mother disapproval levels of speeds.
Yes. I think she translates it to kilometers. It sounds cheap, you know, slower maybe. I don't know.
Ganesh Bell, Managing Director at Insight Partners, once named the 11th most creative person in the world.
Do you know who got 10th? Who kicked you out of 10th?
Oh.
You do know that.
I do not know the 10th. I should know that.
I'm just saying.
But I thought 11 is a cool thing because I've always been a big fan of Spinal Tap.
And you did turn it up to 11.
I did turn it up to 11.
Next week on Sand Hill Road.
Kids who grew up in low-income situations, when they try to get themselves out of it, it takes some time.
Absolutely.
It didn't take you very much time. You bought your parents a house while you were still in college.
I did, yes.
How did that happen?
Frederick Gross, deal lead for Wellington Access Management. That's next week. Sand Hill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni. For more interviews with Silicon Valley's most influential entrepreneurs, check me out on TV at Press Here. That's Sunday mornings on NBC Bay Area and everywhere in the world on iTunes and at PressHereTV.com.